So one way to do this, which we'll be focusing on, is to try to interpret the elements of the formalism of quantum theory in terms of lists of instructions of what to do in the lab. So there's various brands of empiricism where you know, you reduce your descriptions to phenomena. Here we're gonna focus on reducing everything to descriptions of what we do in the lab. Okay, so let's start with this Stern-Gerlach experiment again. So last time I described it as you have an oven with atoms in it. Each atom has a spin. They get spit out. They interact with the magnetic field. They come to the screen. An operationalist wants to say it's a bad idea to talk about an atom and its properties as an explanation of what's going on in this experiment. It's better to just say, write down a recipe for what you did over here. So you set up an experiment, you had an output aperture, you set the whole thing running. Write that down. That's a description of the preparation procedure. And then everything you do here, setting up this magnet and the screen and so forth, is an example of a measurement procedure. What distinguishes the measurement procedure is that it has some outcome. So it has some classical output, which here is just whether you observed a flash here or here. So a preparation doesn't have an outcome. It may have an input. You might have a knob that you can turn here to change what kind of preparation it is, but there's no outcome. So for simplicity, I'm going to draw boxes like these. So this is just going to denote a generic preparation procedure. So imagine that inside this box, there's some experimental equipment that could be, for example, this setup in the Stern-Gerlach experiment. And there's a button on top, which means you press go, and the experiment begins. There's an output aperture. The measurement device has an input aperture and a pointer, which is meant to symbolize the fact that it's going to generate some classical output. Good. So how can we interpret quantum mechanics in this operational way? Well, the preparation procedures in quantum mechanics are associated with vectors in Hilbert space. I'll denote by P a list of instructions. So if you write a recipe for what to do in the lab, that corresponds to some preparation procedure. And according to quantum theory, there should be some vector in Hilbert space that describes that preparation. So an operationalist would say that's how we should interpret the Hilbert space vector. It doesn't represent the physical state of the atom that comes out of the apparatus. It's a representation of that list of instructions of what you did in the lab. And you shouldn't attribute more significance to it than that. And similarly with a measurement, you can associate it with a Hermitian operator. And the operationalist would say that's the meaning of a Hermitian operator. It's a summary of all the information about this list of instructions for what measurement to do. And then any operational theory has to provide an algorithm for calculating the probabilities of the outcomes of a measurement, given a specification of that measurement, and given a specification of the preparation procedure that comes before it. So it needs to tell you the probability for outcome K given P and M. And quantum mechanics does that for you through the Born rule. So it just tells you to take the spectral projector of the Hermitian operator A corresponding to outcome K. So AKs are the eigenvalues of A. Pi Ks are the projectors onto its eigenspaces. And takes the expectation value of that with respect to this vector. So let me just make a brief aside about that. If, for example, your Hermitian operator has no degenerate eigenvalues, then these projectors are just rank one. They project onto a single vector. So I'll write that as phi k. And then the expectation value of that projector can just be written as the overlap of psi with phi k mod squared. So this is probably more familiar to you as an expression of the Born rule than the one in terms of projectors. But what's nice about the one in terms of projectors is that if I consider a Hermitian operator that does have degenerate eigenvalues, like this one here. So again, I'll label the distinct eigenvalues by AK, but now there might be many eigenstates of A that all have the same eigenvalue AK, so I'll label that degeneracy index by J. So now this is the projector onto the kth eigenspace of A, and if I plug that in here, I get just the sum of the mod squareds of psi with all those, with a basis of the kth eigenspace of A. So that's just to put it into maybe slightly more familiar language to you. That's why I have this expectation value here. Another thing to note about this expression is that it doesn't depend at all on the eigenvalues. And that's a bit of a subtle point. So let me say a couple of words about it. You might be accustomed from previous courses on quantum theory to calculating expectation values of Hermitian operators. So if I have a Hermitian operator with this spectral resolution, I calculate the expectation value for state psi, I get this. If the projectors are rank one, so they just project onto some vectors, this is what I get. And so it leaves you with the impression that that's, you know, what that somehow every Hermitian operator is a distinct measurement. But that's not quite right. If I just want to know what are the probabilities of the different outcomes, all I need to do is look at these terms. And the eigenvalues are just a way of labeling the different outcomes. So if I have two Hermitian operators that have exactly the same projectors in their spectral resolution, so exactly the same eigenspaces, but different eigenvalues, they correspond to doing exactly the same thing in the lab, right? Exactly the same measurement device can be used to measure both those Hermitian operators. The only difference will be how I choose conventionally to label the outcomes. One set of eigenvalues or another set of eigenvalues is only a way of labeling the different outcomes of that measurement. So for example, if I take the position operator, or I take the position operator cubed, they have exactly the same eigenspaces, and so they correspond to the same measurement. So in view of that fact, people in foundations of quantum theory and quantum information theory often like to describe measurements not by Hermitian operators, because technically it should be an equivalence class of Hermitian operators that are associated with a measurement. So instead, what you can do is just forget all about the eigenvalues and say, all you care about is a set of projectors labeled by the outcomes, such that when I sum over those projectors, I get the identity operator. And so this set of projectors is sometimes called a projection-valued measure. In this context, where K is discrete, it's sort of odd to be calling it a measure, but in the case where K is continuous, it makes sense to call it a measure. But the convention is to always call it a measure regardless. So this is all that's important about the measurement, is this set of projectors. And then you see, of course, that the Born rule depends only on psi and on these projectors, and so you haven't got any extra redundant information like eigenvalue sitting over here. Okay, so all of that was sort of just a bit of an aside on how to represent measurements if you're an operationalist. Now let's talk about transformations. Yes?
Does the
image
to the other ones?
Yes. So when I start with the Hermitian operator and I find its spectral resolution, these projectors are necessarily orthogonal. They have no overlap. So similarly here, I'm imagining, you know, when I say a projector value measured, I really mean a set of projectors which are all orthogonal to one another and which sum to identity. Later we'll see a generalization of this to positive operator value measures. Then the condition of orthogonality can be relaxed. Other questions? Yes?
Is this a measure in the mathematical sense? And if so, on what set?
Sorry, if so?
If so, on what set?
So here it's not really, because K is a discrete set. Just, for example, an integer describing the different possible outcomes, which I'm here assuming to be discrete. But in other settings, you might imagine a measurement that has a continuum of possible outcomes, and then you would have a continuous label here, and then you could define a measure for that variable. So it all depends on the outcome space of your measurement. So
It doesn't depend on the Hilbert space. It depends on what kind of measurement you're doing. So if your measurement is a measurement of position, then you've got the real numbers as your set. If you have a measurement which does sort of a noisy measurement of position simultaneously with momentum, so there are measurements that tell you something about the position and something about the momentum, then your set is R squared, and it's a measure over R squared. And so it all depends on which measurement you're considering. For the purposes of this course, we won't have much need of measurements that have continuous sets of outcomes. So for simplicity in this discussion, I'm just going to assume discrete outcome sets, because it's mathematically a lot easier. Any other questions? Was the point about Hermitian operators clear? I mean, is anybody uncomfortable with the fact that the eigenvalues of Hermitian operator aren't significant for calculating the probabilities of outcomes of measurements? Everybody's good with that? All right. So the next point I want to consider is transformation procedures. So you might say, well, where does Schrödinger evolution come in for an operationalist? So an operationalist would say evolution should be thought of as just some transformation that occurs between a preparation procedure and a measurement procedure. So this is, again, just some list of instructions of what to do in the lab. And it could be as simple as the instruction to wait a certain amount of time before doing the measurement. That's a particular thing you can do in the lab. So it's a transformation procedure. And the idea is that in quantum theory, that's how we should interpret unitary maps according to the operationalist. They're a representation of some instructions, what to do between a preparation and a measurement procedure. And if you ask, well, what's the probability of getting outcome K if I do a preparation followed by a transformation, followed by this measurement? Well, it's just going to be the expectation value of pi K, the projector associated with that outcome, but not for psi now, but for the unitarily evolved psi. And if I take the bra associated with u psi, it's u dagger psi, u dagger acting on the right. Yes?
So why isn't this just a part of the preparation?
You could certainly think of it that way, like so. So you could say, look, what is a preparation procedure? It's a black box. It has an output port, and it sets things going. So I could just draw a box around all of these guys and say, that's a preparation, right? It's a list of instructions of what to do. And I've just sort of lumped this set of instructions together with that one and said that's the new instruction set. So I can certainly define an effective preparation, P prime. And if you say, suppose you know how this preparation is represented in the formalism by psi, and you know that this transformation is represented by u, a unitary, how should this effective preparation be represented? And the answer is clearly just by some new vector psi prime, which is u psi. And so if I just use my old algorithm of the Born rules for psi prime, I get what I showed you on the last slide here. But there's another way you can think about the transformation. What is it?
Grouped with the measurement.
Exactly, yeah. So instead, I could say, let's put a black box around these guys. What does that correspond to? Well, it's now a box that has an input port, and it generates an outcome. So it meets the definition of a measurement procedure. And if pi k's denote the projector value measure for this measurement, and u is the unitary associated with this transformation, then the effective projector value measure for this measurement here is just u dagger pi k u. And so if I plug that pi prime into the old Born rule, I'll again get the same expression I did before. So for the operationalist, this distinction between how I choose to categorize a transformation as either part of the preparation or part of the measurement is all there is to the distinction between the Schrödinger representation and the Heisenberg representation. Right, so that you might recognize this as the Schrödinger representation and this is the Heisenberg representation. I can act my unitaries to sort of make my measurement operators meet the preparation or make my states meet the measurement, either way. Okay, now what about a measurement that leaves the system, that
after which you could still do measurements on the system. So I put an extra output port on the measurement device here. So in addition to the classical outcome of the measurement, there's now the quantum system that persists. And so again, you can think of this pair of boxes now as some effective preparation procedure. And for every outcome here, you get a different preparation procedure. So you could say, do this and post-select on the case where you get the first outcome. That's a list of instructions of what to do. Therefore, it's another example of a preparation procedure. And if you say, well, I know that this preparation is represented by psi, and I know the projector valued measure or the Hermitian operator that represents this measurement, what operator should I use? What state should I use to describe this effective preparation? The answer is just given by the collapse rule, right? So take psi, project it into the kth eigenspace, and normalize. So according to the operationalists, we should think of the collapse rule as just an algorithm for that takes in a description of a preparation, a description of a measurement, and returns a description of an effective preparation. And that's its significance in the formalism. So questions about that? Clear? All right. So I'm going to continue talking about operationalism for a few more days, but I thought now might be a good time to pause and have a bit of a discussion on whether this approach to scientific theories, trying to stay away from any claims about unobservable entities and their properties, and restricting yourself purely to describing the outcomes of measurements, is it satisfactory or not? So I'll ask you, what do you think?
I would say that many people would probably not agree, but operational interpretation really is useless if you really want to know about how the world works. You're not getting any insight about what really happens there. And even more, if you wanted to take quantum mechanics and apply it somewhere else, it's not very useful to just talk about the operational formulas, because you're not getting any insight as to how this would, say, apply to quantum field theory, where you really want to know what happens in physical processes. And furthermore, you don't know how to couple it to gravity if you just talk about operational formulas.
OK, so let me try to play devil's advocate for the operationalists. They would say, the striving to understand, what's really going on is wrong. That, back in the day of Newton, people asked, how gravity works, why do objects fall, what's the mechanism? But to look for those kinds of mechanisms is really to just be doing metaphysics, and that's not good science. Really what we should be doing is just describing what the motions are, and to describe what the motions are, all we need to do is express things in terms of, everyday concepts, like where you observe the planet to be and how it moves. And here, to describe the phenomenon of quantum mechanics, all you need to do is describe what happens in the lab. And any further attempt at a deeper explanation of what's going on is somehow just metaphysics.
My retort to that would be, Newton was wrong, and we know that Einstein gave us why to answer for gravity using general relativity. So in this similar setup, you could try to answer why for quantum mechanics. And the operational formulas doesn't dive into that for you.
OK. Other views? Yeah.
It's a philosophy, right? Some kind of philosophy point of view to how to look at it. But those kind of why questions doesn't end any time. You can still ask why general relativity is true and
So that's what lets you advance physics. Whereas when you stop asking, you're not going to get to GR if you don't ask why. Right. If you don't ask why, then I don't think you can do any physics at all. You stop at some point and you say, okay, I want to describe stuff, but I'm really not going to get any further insight. I'm just going to be able to describe the things I see. It's not very satisfactory. That depends on you.
Sure. I don't really agree with. I agree that you need to want to understand how things fundamentally work, but at the same time, you could, an operational person could just say that is operational procedure isn't generating the right answer, and then try to modify it. But in a sense, what you're still doing is referring to some model that you have of how things should work, and so you work in the model, and then you go back, and then you modify your operational procedure. So even if you don't talk about physical states or the world, you still go back there when you're modifying your model. And then, you know, you just kind of, you know, once you have your theory off the assembly line, you just, you know, don't worry about how you created it. And
so you're saying even the operationalist tends to appeal to realism, maybe when they're thinking about building new theories, and then they don't advertise that when they present the operational form of the theory.
But I think it's definitely a useful approach if you're just doing like quantum information, like you just want to build like some sort of quantum machine to just think in terms of algorithms and results.
Mm-hmm. So I would say that's certainly true, and most quantum information theorists I know are operationalists. And furthermore, there's people who are committed to realism who will adopt an operational approach for the time being. So the one thing that's nice about this sort of approach is that it's sort of a minimal interpretation of quantum mechanics. It doesn't commit you to much, so you're less prone to make mistakes. So you can just say, let's try to describe the phenomena totally operationally. And then once we've described it in those neutral terms, we can now start asking which of various realist interpretations might better account for that phenomena. And I think you're sort of saying something similar, that operationalism can be a useful methodological tool. Mark?
Yeah, mine was going to kind of say that realism can be a useful tool. Because when you do have to create new theories, if you have like a large kind of narrative about what's happening, it might be easier to find where you have to modify that narrative. So working in like an elaborate description of what's going on could be helpful when you come across empirical inadequacies, because you have more to work with than just a bare bones kind of thing like an operationalist would have. So even on pragmatic grounds, realism could be useful because it makes it easier to move on from one theory to the next.
Right. Yeah, good. In fact, if you look at the if you look at history and say which of these two approaches has methodologically been more useful for coming up with new theories relative to what came before,
I'm not a historian, but from my perspective, the scorecards are kind of even. So on the one hand, you've got say the atomic hypothesis. So in the 19th century, people had huge debates over whether the idea of atoms could explain the phenomena they observed in chemistry. And there was a certain set of people who said it was just fundamentally misguided and just metaphysics to be talking about atoms. And really, the appropriate notions to describe chemistry were, you know, concentrations of chemicals and what you saw in a chemical reaction. And Mach, for example, who I mentioned last time, was in favor of an operational approach, was against atoms. And I think history showed that camp lost, that the atomic hypothesis was useful and helped us understand chemistry. And most people today would, you know, grant that we should the world is made of atoms. On the other hand, if you look at the birth of special relativity, that's a nice example of how people's concepts of space and time prevented them from making the leap that Einstein did. Einstein really needed to talk about purely operational concepts, like what does it mean to be at a particular time? It means that my watch is synchronized with the clock. And so he really thought about synchrony in an operational way. And by doing that, he was able to overthrow the notion of space-time that had come before. So in that case, operationalism was sort of a liberating force that can, you know, free you from preconceptions and realist baggage of theories that came before. Now, if you look at quantum theory, I think the story of quantum theory is interesting because you've got, on the one hand, Heisenberg, who's developing quantum theory from a very operational approach. If you read his original matrix mechanics paper, he talks about how, you know, the object is going to be just to specify what the frequencies of atomic transitions are and not to talk about any, you know, model of the atom in terms of some sort of planetary motion. And on the other hand, you have Schrödinger, who developed wave mechanics from a realist perspective. He was looking at things like Maupertuis principle and Fermat's principle of least action and de Broglie's work. And he really had this notion of a density of stuff propagating in space. So it seems to me that in quantum mechanics, you know, you had both approaches got you to quantum theory, and then eventually people saw how to combine them. So all that to say that I think there's both your points are right, that methodologically both these approaches can be useful. But what about somebody who says, I'm not interested in operationalism as a methodological prescription for making progress. I think that it's really all we should strive for, that it's not a way of getting a better realist interpretation. It's just all this realism is somehow just metaphysics, and we shouldn't be interested in it, and the role of science is to describe the phenomena and nothing more. Is that all right? Is there anybody who would subscribe to that point of view? And if not, what's wrong with it? Because I should say, I haven't said anything about the Copenhagen interpretation, partly because if you, you know, there's just so many different versions of the Copenhagen interpretation. And what Bohr said is not, strictly speaking, operationalist. But there is a large element of operationalism in that program. The Copenhagen interpretation arose out of the Heisenberg-Bohr school, which was more committed to the notion that we should just describe the experimental phenomena. So this is, in some respects, a kind of standard idea. So, well, what's the problem? Yes?
I would say that that's a too fundamental view of trying to disqualify other approaches to science. I don't think it's wrong for someone to work with that as a starting point, but I think if you're excluding everyone that works more in realist terms, if you want to exclude people who are irrealist from doing science, that's just preposterous, because that will actually be a useful way to find new physics. Since we don't have, like, on each level of complexity, or each, like, go zooming in on smaller distances, we find new phenomena that we can think of as real, even though if they might not be fundamental. So I think we need the interplay, and we can't be that fundamental of saying that we have to cut out the one part. So.
Okay, so you favor pluralism.
Yeah, I favor pluralism.
Yes.
2 points. I think the second one goes a bit into the direction what Hjalmar just said. Other way around. For me, this operational view is kind of metaphysics, because if it tries to discreditize realism as something that we are not allowed to talk about this, then it kind of forbids us to talk about something that we in theory could talk about, and such constructs sort of a meta theory about what we can talk about what is scientific to talk about. And so making quantum theory, or even an operational approach to this theory, would not be a theory, but a meta theory about the knowable or about the sayable, speakable, whatever. And this is perhaps not the right place for a physical theory to be, because physical theories always have to be tested. Operational approach, realist approach. Up to now, there's no way to discriminate between them by experiment. The first point I wanted to say is, operationally, I don't see, if I put myself on an operational point of view, why there should be laws of nature at all. If there is something out there, something real, then it's still not trivial why these things should follow something you can describe with mathematics. But if the only thing we can do is measure, I don't see why these measurements should be repeatable and should be, there's, I think, no fundamental notion for that. Perhaps there is, but not to my knowledge, why we could relate these measurements to each other and repeat experiments and get the same outcome, if there is not something out there that behaves the same.
Mm-hmm. So let me feed off that 2 points. The first point is, when you said, you know, that there should be testable differences, that kind of comment normally would be taken in support of this sort of approach. Like the operationist said, the problem with realism is that by invoking unobservable entities in your explanations, you run the risk of, you know, making some claims that just have no experimental significance. And so the operationist was motivated to try to come up with a criterion for meaningfulness in terms of testability. So the logical positivists, for example, had this thing called the verificationist criterion. And they said basically a proposition is only scientifically meaningful if you could specify what experiment would test it, what experiment would verify it. And so this, in this way, they tried to rule out, talk about metaphysics and put it together with talk about religion, for example, that those kinds of statements can't be verified, they're not science. Now, since then, Karl Popper criticized logical positivism and nobody really believes in it. And the verificationist criteria was replaced with the falsification criteria. But the idea is still similar, that the operationalist is trying to ensure somehow that we can really have only testable claims in our theory. Now, if I can respond to that objection, what you'll see by the end of the course, and this connects, I guess, with what Mark was saying earlier, these various different realist interpretations that people come up with do suggest ways of modifying quantum theory, do suggest predictions that aren't part of the standard quantum formalism. So the particular realist picture you have can influence the direction in which you generalize your theory. And so it's a good source of ideas for how to go beyond a theory. So we'll see how the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation gets you to some new predictions. Collapse theories get you to some new predictions. So in that sense, even the realist can say, well, ultimately, we can make testable predictions based on our methodology as well. And then the second point you made was about, just remind me what the second point was?
Where should laws of nature come from? Is there anything
we
can do this measure?
Yeah. So that reminds me of an objection to, let me start over. So there's an American Nobel laureate by the name of Percy Bridgman, and he espoused an operational approach, mostly because he was shocked at what happened with special relativity. It thought it was, it looked poorly on scientists that there should be such a revolution in how we thought about space-time. He said, it's okay if that happens once, but that should never happen again. He says the problem was that ahead of time, people had a notion of length as some sort of physical property. And he said what would be better is to have a notion of length that was operationally defined. So let's say you want to know the length of a streetcar. Well, here's a procedure for how to measure it. Get on the streetcar and lay down meter sticks, find its length. Or calculate, measure the velocity of the streetcar, time when the front of the streetcar passes you, and then when the back of the streetcar passes you, and calculate the length that way. And he says, look, if we had had those kinds of notions of length, operational notions, then we wouldn't have been tempted to equate them, and we wouldn't necessarily have been shocked by special relativity. We would have realized that these things could, in fact, be different. But the objection to that sort of approach is that if you go too far and you say, I'm not willing to make any abstractions, then you really can't do science. So you could say, well, if I measure the length of the streetcar on a day where I had Cheerios for breakfast, maybe that's relevant. So that's a different procedure from if I have cornflakes. So we can't equate those two concepts. Obviously it just gets ridiculous. But I think that's similar to what you're saying, that you sort of need a certain amount of abstraction to make progress. And if you're too strict of an operationalist, then maybe you have trouble making those kinds of abstractions. Other thoughts? Actually, let me see if there's anyone else who wants to.
I think the first point I would say, probably, if I understand you, is that this statement that everything that you claim should be testable, this claim itself is not testable. So there are somehow inconsistencies in itself. No. So I think an operationalist cannot say this statement because it's not testable.
Okay. Fair enough. Other thoughts on the status of operationalism? Yes?
How do you progress in the operational view? It seems more like to me like trying to describe what we already know. But how do you find new things and go beyond what we know?
That's a good question. I guess the operationalist could say, look, we're going to make measurements, we're going to do new preparations, new measurements. As soon as we see a deviation from quantum mechanics, then it'll be our job to figure out what mathematical formalism would be appropriate for describing those new predictions we see. And then we'll have to come up with a new theory.
Or maybe something like, I mean, we overthink about the concepts we already have and say, for example, which of them are meaningful and which of them are not meaningful, and then, say something new. I'm thinking about something the same as special relativity when we reorganized what we already knew about space and time in a manner that is meaningful and what is not meaningful. So we ended up with this special relativity, and I think that might, that still can make progress. Yeah.
So what is
Go ahead.
So what does meaningful mean for an operationalist?
Yeah, I would say that meaningful would fall under the realist perspective.
Yes.
Like asking why. So if you're asking whether something's meaningful, it'd be the same as asking why you have this result.
What does it mean, why?
Well, what we're saying right now is that if you're describing something with this operational approach, and if you ask why, that's immediately realist, so we can't do that.
I'm not saying you have to be that much a strict operationalist.
Yeah, okay.
But
strangely, last year in this course, somebody said, "What do you mean, why?" Exactly. Top of the question. Andrew, did you have
a? So I had a point with too many, so maybe bringing this a little bit down to the ground. Is it meaningful to think about the two different approaches as in comparing thermodynamics and statistical mechanics, for example? Or you really think about the operational as thermodynamics, you really don't care about what's going on. You can answer every possible question from there, more or less. And then statistical mechanics comes along and you can explain everything that's going on underneath it all.
Yeah, I think
statistical mechanics might give you a few more answers than thermodynamics can. So it seems reasonable that operational approach is not the proper way to do science.
It's interesting. So Einstein described thermodynamics as his inspiration for his approach to special relativity, the operational approach. He made a distinction between principle theories and constructive theories. So principle theories proceed by starting with some principles like the second law of thermodynamics or the relativity postulate and the length postulate and derive consequences. And constructive theories start with statements about what are the entities and what are the dynamics, and then you infer how, say, clocks and meter sticks behave from that. And ultimately, Einstein favored coming up with a constructive theory. He saw the principle theory approach as sort of a shortcut. And so in the context of quantum theory, Einstein was a proponent of trying to find what was to quantum theory as statistical mechanics is to thermodynamics. So Einstein thought there was some invariable model. And there's a famous quote when Heisenberg sort of challenged him and said, look, you were the guy who introduced the operationalism and special relativity, so why aren't you on board with this? And Einstein's response was, a good joke should not be repeated too many times.
In some sense, there's like a philosophical conflict between like rationalism and empiricism where, you either want to base everything you consider true off of a bunch of axioms or off of experiments. But if you look at how people actually live, it's not really true to say that you can do one or the other. It's kind of like the constructive thing where you go throughout your day and all the data you're taking in is a series of little experiments. And then you form all your rational, evaluations and based on the concepts you get from these little experiments you do every day. So in a sense, because we're physicists and we use axioms, but we also use experiments, we have to embody both empiricism and rationalism together. And in a sense, that is kind of the constructive approach, because you're just constructing a theory of the world based on experiments. And then, you know, you make jumps of logic and you try out new principles, but it's still kind of, you still do need both of these. And I think it is a little dishonest to say that you can, that only, that you should take a pure operational view of the whole world, and because that's just, it isn't exactly the same as picking rationalism or empiricism, mm-hmm. but it's kind of the same split.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. To some extent, Karl Popper's response to previous forms of empiricism, like logical positivism, was to say, you know, that one of the primary motivations of that whole school of thought was to achieve some kind of certainty, to not be misled. And, you know, people in epistemology have worried about that for a long time. We wouldn't be certain of anything. And Popper's response was, you can't. You know, you have to sort of stick your neck out, make a hypothesis, you know, maybe take a rationalist approach, start with some ideas, and then confront them with experiment. And sometimes experiment will show that your ideas are wrong, but that's how we make progress, by because we're fallible. So I just wanted to add that to what you're saying, that you know, maybe one of the things that's wrong about operationalism, it's a bit too conservative in terms of trying to be certain about everything. Maybe in the real world, it's better to say, you know, we're going to be wrong, but we just need to try to, as Wheeler once said, you know, let's make the mistakes as quickly as possible. Okay, so we should probably move on.
No, just one kind of remark.
Yeah.
A bit unrelated, but I think I've just found out that what you mean with why comes from.
Okay.
This Feynman quote in the Feynman lectures, just looked it up. We can't define anything precisely. If we attempt to do, we get into that paralysis of thought that comes by philosophers, one saying to the other, you don't know what you're talking about. The second says, what do you mean by talking? What do you mean by you? What do you mean by no?
Yes. Thank you. Okay, so let me end with a final commentary on operationalism, which hasn't quite come up. So one response, which I quite like, is that when the operationalist says, look, so some operationalists do say, you know, I'm happy with having explanations of what's going on, but to my mind, explanations should bottom out with statements about every, that are expressed in terms of everyday concepts. So when you want to explain the behavior of an electron, that's fine, but what you're really doing is you're talking about what would occur if you were to do a measurement on an electron, and, you know, what you would observe. And so all your explanations ultimately reduce to statements about observed phenomena. And the problem with that is that the, you know, a detector going click doesn't feel like the sort of thing that should be at the bottom of your explanations. It seems like the kind of thing that science can explain. You know, for example, you know, why are there detectors in the first place? You know, why are there people here on the planet who can build detectors? It seems like that's the sort of thing that science should be in the business of explaining, and presumably involves some explanation in terms of natural selection. And if you take it further back, there'll be some explanation in terms of solar evolution as to, you know, why there's a planet that can support life at all. And, you know, if you take it far enough back, there's some explanation in terms of cosmology. And a problem that a lot of people have with the operational approach is that it's unclear how you could have a story about natural selection and the origin of life and stellar evolution and cosmology if all your explanations are meant to reduce to detectors going click and what you see in experiments. So that, regardless of where you may, what you might think now, we're going to get back to realist interpretations eventually, of course. But in the time being, I'm going to continue talking about an operational approach. And so I'm going to do that for a couple of reasons. You know, one is it's a minimal interpretation of quantum theory. So even if you might at heart be a realist, you can still follow the operational approach just to get clear on what does the theory tell us without any extra baggage. So it's a useful way of presenting the basic formalism of quantum mechanics in a kind of neutral way. So I'm going to do that. And secondly, there's been a lot of work in recent years of people trying to come up with axioms to derive quantum theory. And what they're deriving is an operational interpretation of quantum theory. Okay, so this is going to be a bit of a setup for what comes later this week, where you're going to see what some ideas about axiomatization of quantum theory. So for the last 10 minutes or so, I'm going to start on the project of telling you more
about the formalism from an operational perspective. Okay, so far I've told you that preparations are associated with vectors in Hilbert space. But it turns out that's not quite right. There, if you say, what is the most general sort of preparation associated with in the formalism, it's not a vector in Hilbert space. It's actually a density operator. So you've seen this already in Adrian's course. Now I'm going to go over it again, just with this operational gloss on it. So the first thing you need to know is about the trace operation. So let me remind you about that. It's basically defined this way here. The k's are a complete orthonormal basis for the Hilbert space that A operates on. And here's an identity that'll be useful. If I take the product of A and an outer product of psi and psi prime, and I trace, I just get psi prime A psi. The proof is pretty straightforward. Just use the definition of the trace here. I get this. These two are now scalars, so they commute. So I can change the order of these two terms. And now I can pull this sum over k inside and recognize that this is just the identity operator on the Hilbert space. And so it falls out, and I'm just left with this, which is the identity I wanted to prove. And then the second identity that'll be useful to us is that if I just have trace of some outer product of psi and psi prime, well, then that's just psi prime psi. And I get that from this guy just by plugging in A equal to the identity operator and using that result. OK, so hopefully this is familiar to you. Certainly you're going to be seeing it in yesterday's and today's tutorial. So let me give you the first simplest example of a scenario wherein a vector is not enough. It won't describe a preparation procedure. So here's a perfectly good preparation procedure. It's a box. So that's this outline here with an output aperture. And inside of it are three other boxes, which each correspond to preparations, which I would describe by psi 1, psi 2, and psi 3. And the way it's going to work is that I'm going to roll some dice and choose one of these three guys at random, and then output whatever comes out of the device I chose. OK, so it could be a probability third for each one of these three, for example. All right, so now I want to know, what should I associate with the whole box if I want to make predictions about the outcomes of a future measurement? Because that's what an operationalist wants. They want a mathematical object that will allow them to predict the outcomes of any future measurement. So we just use classical probability theory. We want to know, what's the probability of outcome k of that measurement? And we know what the probability of outcome k is given that you did a particular one of these preparations. So if you did psi 1, then we already know what the probabilities will be. So I just take the probability of k given I times the probability of I, which is just the probability that you've done any one of these guys, and sum over I. That'll give me the overall probability of k. But this probability of k given I is just given by the Born rule. That's this here. And the probability of I is just whatever probability is defined these dice. So that's this. And now I use that identity I just showed you, that the expectation value of pi k is the same as the trace of pi k times the projector onto psi I. And then I can move the sum over I inside. And pi is a scalar, so it can move inside as well. And I can group them all together as one operator on the Hilbert space. And that operator I'll call rho. And it's usually referred to as the density operator. It's defined this way. And it will predict the outcomes of this measurement when all I know is that this procedure has been done. So the idea is that if you've got a box, inside of it you're choosing one of these guys at random, but you don't learn which one was prepared. So that doesn't come outside of the box. So you know it was one of them, and you know what their relative probabilities were, but you don't know which one. Then you should assign this operator to the box. Yes?
Is not a superposition of these three.
That's right. The way I've described it, you really know that one of them is being done. It's just that it's chosen at random. So you just have ignorance about which value of I occurred. So this is sometimes described as a mixture of the states psi I with probabilities pi. So it's clear that no individual vector would be able to reproduce these predictions, because psi 1 and, one way to see it is that I could have no predictability about the outcomes of this measurement. And there's no vector in Hilbert space that would get me there. But there is a mixture of vectors that can give me no predictability. All right, let me make a couple comments about that. So a set of vectors and probabilities will be called an ensemble of states. So we take the vectors to be normalized. They don't have to be orthogonal. The PIs are going to be probabilities that sum to 1. And every ensemble like this will define a density operator through this equation. And you'll see more about this in the tutorial today. The operator that you define in that way is positive. So it means that if I take the expectation value of rho for any state in the Hilbert space, I get something that's a positive number. The proof is pretty straightforward. If you take the expectation value of rho for this expression, bring it in here, it's just the overlap of psi with psi I squared. These are all positive. The PIs are all positive. Therefore, the sums of them are positive. So it's a positive operator. And it has unit trace. Trace of rho is equal to 1. And the way to see that is you just take the trace of the right-hand side here. The trace of this outer product is just the inner product between these guys. That was one of the identities I showed you earlier. These guys are normalized, so this is 1. The probability distribution normalized, so that's 1. So those are the two properties that a density operator has. If your density operator is just the projector onto some vector on Hilbert space, then it's called a pure state. And what that means is that there's no way of writing that density operator as a mixture of other operators. So there's only one decomposition of it into this vector. And so it's extremal in the space of convex combinations of operators. Not so important. Just remember that if it's a projector, it's a rank one projector, it's pure. If it's a mixture with these PIs, more than one of these PIs being non-zero, then it's said to be a mixed state. In the Bloch sphere, these were the guys on the surface. These were the guys in the interior. And now another nice thing about using density operators is that even if I'm describing a pure state, so I have a vector in Hilbert space, remember that the global phase factor of a vector was not significant for the outcomes of any measurement. You could always change that global phase factor. If I calculate the density operator associated with this guy, it's just this times its dual, which means I have to take the complex conjugate of this, and the phase factors cancel out. So I just get this. So what's nice about using density operators, even for pure states, is that the number of parameters required to specify a density operator actually reflects the number of degrees of freedom you have experimentally. As you vary the parameters in this, you'll always change the statistics for some measurement. So there's nothing like this global phase factor, which is physically irrelevant. So that's a nice feature of the density operators. Good. One point that we came to at the end of yesterday's lecture was the difference between a state that has coherence between two elements of some basis and one that doesn't. So if I take this pure state here and I calculate its density operator, so I just have to take this, take its dual, multiply them together as an outer product, and I just get a squared projector onto 0, b squared projector onto 1, plus these cross terms. That's a different density operator from this one, which just has the first two terms. So in terms of the density operator language, you can tell the difference between coherence and no coherence just by looking at the density operator. And there's always some measurement that will tell these two sorts of states apart. So for example, if I do the measurement which projects onto this state psi, so let's say we're in a two-dimensional Hilbert space, it's the measurement corresponding to the basis psi and the state perpendicular to psi, then if this is the state, I'll get this outcome with probability 1 and the other outcome with probability 0. But if this is the state, I'll have some probability for each outcome. And so there's always some measurement that can tell these two sorts of states apart.
Good. Now, in the context of the quantum measurement problem that we were discussing yesterday, one of the false starts that I didn't mention was an idea that people have had that maybe we should just interpret this entangled state. Remember, this was when I interact a spin with an apparatus and I end up with a coherent superposition of spin up, apparatus indicates up, plus spin down, apparatus indicates down. People said, well, what if we just interpret this as meaning either this guy or this guy with probabilities a squared and b squared respectively? Why don't we just interpret it that way? And the problem is that if you did, then you would ultimately be saying that, you know, your state is an incoherent mixture of this guy and this guy, and you'd make different predictions. In particular, if you could do a measurement that projects onto this state, that would be very hard because this is a macroscopic device. But in principle, there's such a measurement, and this state would make a different prediction from this mixture here. Okay, I think maybe we should stop here. I'll start next time by, well, actually, no, if I think I started a few minutes late. So let me just go for a few more minutes, talk about reduced density operators. You're going to see this in the tutorial later today. So now's probably a good time to talk about it. So it's another scenario in which a vector in Hilbert space is not sufficient for representing a preparation procedure. The idea is, imagine a preparation of a pair of systems. I'll call one S, that's sort of the main system, and the other one A, which stands for auxiliary system or ancilla. And I prepare the pair of them in some pure state, psi SA. Now suppose I just ignore this guy, and I just focus on S, and I do some measurements on it. So I put this whole thing in a box, and I only let the system S come out. And the answer and the question is, how should I represent this preparation procedure, where I've taken half of this bipartite state? Okay, well, to tell you about that, you need to know about the partial trace operation. So first, let me define the partial inner product. So suppose you have a vector on the Hilbert space for S, and another vector on the tensor product of the Hilbert space of S and the Hilbert space of A. And I take this inner product. So this is a sort of a funny beast, because here I've got a vector on this Hilbert space, and here I've got a vector on this guy. Well, this sort of inner product leaves you with a vector on the Hilbert space HA. The way to think about it is clear from an example. So suppose you have an entangled state on SA of this form here. And then I take the inner product with psi s. Well, the natural thing to do is just take the inner product with these terms here. And so if I look at what I get left over, these inner products are just scalars. So I just have a linear combination of vectors on A with scalars. So the whole thing is just a vector on A. So that's why this partial inner product just leaves me with a vector on the Hilbert space for A. So with that in mind, you can define the partial trace on a Hilbert space HS, so trace over S, of some operator on SA, as just a sum, you know, the standard definition, you just sum over a complete orthonormal basis for S on the left and the right here. And although this operator here is defined on the full Hilbert space, I could expand it as a sum of tensor products of operators on S and operators on A, and just take these expectation values for the operators on S. And I'll just get what's left over will be some operator on HA. You'll be using the partial trace this afternoon. So here's another fact about it that's useful. If I have the trace over a pair of systems, S and A, for some operator on SA, then I can factorize it as trace over A followed by trace over S. And the proof is just that if this is an orthonormal basis for S and this is an orthonormal basis for A, then this is an orthonormal basis for the full space, SA. So this is one way I could do the trace over the pair of systems. And so I can just think of that as doing the trace over A first, followed by the trace over S. Okay, so what's the answer to this problem? Okay, let's just ask again what the probability for outcome K is. So I know that here I've prepared a state on SA, which is just described by psi. And what I'm measuring effectively is something non-trivial on S and nothing on A. So you can think of not learning anything about A, ignoring A, as just measuring the identity operator. So that's also a set of projectors that sums to identity. It's just identity. It's one projector, and you know, it clearly sums to identity. So this corresponds to measuring nothing on A. So I can think of the measurement that's being done on S and A together as just this measurement on S tensored with identity on A. So this is the overall measurement on the pair of systems. So I already know from the Born rule that this should be the probability of outcome K when I do this measurement on the pair. So right now I'm sort of drawing the box sort of here and saying over here I've got a measurement on the pair of systems. But now I can turn this trace over SA into a pair of traces. So I first do the trace over A and then the trace over S. And the trace over A can move through this identity and just take the trace over A of this object here, this bipartite state. And this, remember, you know, this is an operator on SA. I'm tracing over A. So that's a, the whole thing is an operator on S. That's what I showed you. And I'll call it rho S. Here's its definition. So this is called the reduced density operator on S of the state psi SA. And it will allow me to calculate the probabilities for the different outcomes K via this formula. So I told you that. I'm not going to go through this, but you can prove that it is also a positive operator, and it also has unit trace. So it has exactly the same properties as a mixture of pure states. You'll see some examples this afternoon, so I'll also skip through this. And so let me just end here you can characterize a density operator intrinsically just in terms of these properties, positivity and unit trace. And what you can show is that for every operator that has those properties, you can always find an ensemble of pure states that sum to that operator. And you can always find a pure state on a pair of copies of the system such that the reduced density operator on one of those systems is rho. And in fact, you can find many decompositions and many purifications. Okay, so let me end there, and we'll come back to the operational approach tomorrow. Thanks.